Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Welcome to this week's podcast guest, Rod Jeffries. Now, I'm going to have a good go at this, and I mean no disrespect if I do not pronounce this correctly. But Rod Jeffries is a Wakanyatan of the Kenyan Kihaka Niwakataroten, residing at home on the Kenhekitiki Nitikiwaka Non, which is actually Turtle Clan Mohawk in Ontario in Canada. For the past 36 years, he has worked in the fields of substance abuse, healing, wellness and treatment as manager, workshop trainer facilitator, program developer and evaluator. In the past 3 decades, his efforts have focused on the development and delivery of programs and staff for working with survivors of trauma, cultural oppression, sexual abuse and residential boarding schools. In recent years, Rod has become well known for his work on trauma, shame and lateral violence across Canada and also in New Zealand. He is the chairperson of the International Indigenous Council for Healing Our Spirit Worldwide. Rod's involvement with HOSW began in 1991, prior to the first gathering in Edmonton, Alberta in 1992. Thank you for joining us, Rod, and it's great to have you.
Rod Jeffries, thanks so much for talking to me and spending some time with me and sharing your story, your journey, your insights with our listeners. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Rod, you're obviously from Canada, for people that don't know you, but do you want to give our listenership a little bit of background, a little bit of context? Tell us about the country you're from and the people and the culture.
Okay. I currently live in Canada. I am Mohawk and Cree, although I take my mother's line because Mohawks are matriarchal. And so I live at home, which is the Tiononega Mohawk territory. But I always like to acknowledge my father because he is from a different First Nation. I grew up all over the place, mostly because both my mother and father were disconnected from their home communities as they both attended Indian residential schools. And of course, if you don't know much about them, they were established by church and state in the 1800s to get rid of the Indian within us. So basically, the schools were set up for us to be ashamed of who we are, the color of our skin, and the way of our people. So it was to take the Indian out of the child. And so they learned a lot of negative things about who they are. And of course, as we know now, all of those things were intergenerational. So a lot of that got passed down to me. And if you're not familiar with what has happened in Canada, a year ago, June 2021, the remains of 215 children were found.
We saw that. I saw that on the news.
At the site of one residential school. And since then, more First Nations have been looking into the residential schools, and I think there's an additional, I'm going to say roughly 3,000 more.
Schools.
Bodies have been recovered. And I'm saying recovered because a lot of our people knew they were buried there, but no one would listen. And so the more schools are researched, I believe that the more bodies will be recovered. And so when you think about 215 children at one school, and I know at another school in Saskatchewan, the graves of, I think, 800 and some were found as well.
That is devastating.
And in the last 25, 30 years, we've been dealing a lot with what occurred at the residential schools, all the abuse that took form, and abuse in every way, shape, and form took place at these schools. And in the mid-90s, I and two colleagues developed the first treatment program for residential school survivors. So basically, we had to deal with all the traumas they experienced. And you know, our end goal was for them to be peaceful with who they are, to be at peace with themselves.
When you say if I go back to so many things I want to ask you about this, Rod, but if we go back to, you mentioned Mohawk, that's the country that your mother's side is from. Is that like a region?
No, that is more our nation.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah,
so I'm from the Mohawk Nation.
Okay, in Canada.
In Canada, yes.
And so what was it like for them pre-1800s, nomadic? Were they roaming around the land on their nation?
What was life like? Our original homeland, although where I live now is part of our traditional territory, but our original homeland was Upper New York State.
Oh, okay.
And because the Mohawk sided with the English, and when they lost the war against the Americans, we had to move or be persecuted further. So that's when we moved to our current location on the north side of Lake Ontario. Yeah.
And so life there would have been a pretty sophisticated civilization, were they, Mohawk people? Tell us about that.
Yeah, pre-contact, we had all of our own institutions, and everything was governed through our longhouse. And it was the core of our communities. And so all of our institutions operated out of the longhouse, whether it be governance, justice, health, education, all those institutions were alive and well. And of course, we were very, as with any First Nation, very connected to the land and the water. Mm-hmm. And there were all the teachings along with that. And of course, what guided us as Mohawk was the great law of peace. So the last word being key, it was around peace.
Yeah. That's incredible. When you say the longhouse, is that literally one big building where everything happened inside of that?
Yes, and people lived in the extended family within the longhouse as well. But all the ceremonies, all the laws that were being implemented all happened within the longhouse.
And did each tribe have their own longhouse around the nation?
It's different.
Okay.
From nation to nation. Some of the nations on the West Coast have a longhouse or what they call a big house. So it was very similar on the West of Canada. But other nations had their own form of governance and their own institutions.
And they coexisted for some time, I guess, all the different nations in Canada.
Yeah, and there were lots of trade routes between the nations. And there was some warring going on, but that's typical.
Did it extend down into what we know now as North America? Was that all just...
North America, North, Central, and South America were filled with Indigenous people.
Yeah.
Filled with Indigenous people. And of course, when the English and the Spanish and the Portuguese covered us, that they wanted the land and the resources, so tried to do us in.
Just it rhymes with a lot of other countries, doesn't it?
With New Zealand and with Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah, the colonization efforts just never seem to stop.
Yeah.
And what I've seen about colonization is that the colonization efforts are getting much, much stronger and more subtle as opposed to being blatant.
Okay. Stronger but subtle. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's almost contradictory in terms. Whereas,
it is very much.
Yeah, wow.
Yes. For example, and I think this goes with any Indigenous nation, that you say no to government, you're going to pay for it at some point or another.
Yeah.
Whether your funding gets pulled or they steer you in a different direction using money or keep you more and more dependent.
Yeah.
And so it's very difficult to grow as a nation when you're forced to be dependent.
I want to get on that a bit more too, Rod. But if we go back to let's go back now to the 1800s when European settlers came over and they forced their way on the lands there on the Mohawk Nation. Tell us the peaceful beings that were overrun and made to, were they enslaved as well?
There was some slavery, but not a lot. But we were treated as slaves, well, we weren't slaves per se. And so we were forced onto plots of land, which are called reserves in Canada. And for a long time, we needed permits to leave. And of course, the reserves were very small in comparison to our traditional territory. And so a lot of our men couldn't leave to go hunting and fishing. So there was another form of dependency. And even with when the residential schools were established, if you didn't send your child or prevented your child from going, you would either be starved or put in jail. So what a lot of parents did was left the community and went and hid in the bush out on the land so their children didn't have to go because they knew how abusive the schools were.
And do they hunt these people down and track them?
In some cases, yes. And what happened in probably most of the residential schools when children ran away, and they would run away 7, 8, 9 years old because the abuse was so horrible in these institutions that the children were tracked down and then punished for running away. And a lot of children never made it home, never made it back. And so some of them may have starved to death. So some may have froze to death because of the extreme weather.
So let's talk about the impact that's had. So the culture was there living for thousands of years, right? And then, so once this has happened and the invasion has occurred, do we see them also trying to suppress the culture, stop speaking the languages?
Very much. And of course, when the residential schools were set up and a lot of it's called Indian day schools, the language was beaten out of us, literally beaten out of us. And so even if some of the children retained the language, they feared for their own children, so never taught their children the language. And so what's happening in a lot of nations across Canada is the revitalization of our languages, because language is who you are. And it defines who you are. So languages are extremely important to any. And so the government is recognizing a bit in terms of what they did in residential schools. And so have provided some funding so we can revitalize our languages. Like, for example, in my community, we don't have any first language speakers alive anymore.
Yeah, so what do you do?
We have speakers in our community now that have learned, which is our language, as their second language, but we don't have any first language speakers left in our community.
Was there some sort of resource they could go to learn that, was there? Or it was just passed down through?
Traditionally, you grew up in the language.
Yeah.
Because English didn't exist then. And so we learned the language. So that was the only language we knew. And then, of course, it was beaten out of us. And, of course, all the other abuses that took place as well. Like, for example, in Canada, our ceremonies were banned for a long time. We could not practice our ceremonies. And if we did, went to jail. Now, a lot of our elders and medicine people took the ceremonies underground. They still practiced them. And that happened to a degree with our languages as well. They wouldn't speak our languages in public. And so when you think about all the efforts that were made to destroy us as a people, like we couldn't even gather as a people. Gathering was banned. It was against the law for Indians to gather. And in looking at that piece, I believe First Nations people got the right to vote in Canada. I think it was 1960.
Wow.
That's not that long ago. The last residential school closed in 1996.
Wow. So the definition of a residential school is where kids were forced to be sent to.
Yes.
Is that correct? State run?
State funded, operated by the churches.
Okay. And that was to convert them into Christianity or something, was it? Catholic?
To make us good little white people.
Okay. To conform.
Yes.
And so they lived on there, they ate on there, their parents weren't on there with them, right?
No.
So they were taken from their parents, that forcefully?
Forcefully, yes.
Taken away from the age of what, 5?
Some as early as 4.
Wow.
But usually it was around 4 or 5. For example, my father spent 11 years in the school.
Okay.
He didn't have a clue what family was. He grew up in an institution, like many of our people did. And I know here in Australia, there's very similar stories.
And so were your family all there as well, like your cousins or your...
Yes, but if you had siblings, if I was in the school and had sisters, I wouldn't see them because we were kept totally separate.
Girls and boys or girls, siblings?
Siblings, girls and boys were totally separate.
Wow.
And many of the children could not go home for holidays. Some spent...
Year-round, though.
Year-round, yeah. So some were able to go back for summer, maybe Christmas.
And Rod, I'm not picturing the sort of... the summer camp style things, like these would have been not pleasant.
They were jails.
Were they really? So the sleeping in conditions would have been just learning stuff all day, probably limited playtime outside.
Very little, very limited playtime. A lot of starvation occurred in these schools, submission by starvation and submission by all every abuse. The sexual abuse by the people around the schools was rampant.
Is that right?
Most of the schools were run, or I should say about two-thirds of the schools were run by the Roman Catholic Church. Sexual abuse was off the wall.
It's just devastating, isn't it, that they had to experience such. Yeah.
But you know what I look to? As devastating as it is, think of the strength of those children to survive.
Yeah.
And to continue to survive, yes, in terms of dealing with all the trauma and all the abuse, there was a lot of acting out behavior, a lot of addiction, a lot of violence, a lot of anger, which was put on their families as well. And of course, there's such a strong intergenerational impacts of residential schools. And so we're seeing a lot of issues around emotional well-being, lots of trauma that needs to be dealt with. And of course, one of the big impacts of trauma is shame, the feeling of not being good enough, feeling of being unwanted, unworthy, and unlovable. And so that piece is really important to look at, all the trauma. And so over the last 25 years, a lot of work has been done to deal with the trauma, the pain, and the hurt. And where I prefer to come from is that strength-based foundation. Yeah. And
When they left school or residential school, were they then able to go back to their families? Like, what happened?
In the early years, yes, they would go back to their communities, but because they couldn't speak the language, they couldn't communicate.
So the parents were still back at where they were from and allowed to speak the language still?
Yes.
Okay, in the reserve.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay,
and so many of the children could not speak the language when they returned home. So communication was very difficult. And then, of course, because they experienced so much pain in those schools, they attempted at a solution to get rid of the pain. You know what that solution is?
Using substances.
Yes, alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol. And while it's not a healthy solution, it worked because the pain was so extraordinary about what happened in those schools.
And so you said the last one was closed in 96.
Yes. That's only 26 years ago.
Yeah. That was happening all the way up until then.
Yeah.
And so then back on to what you were saying, the news that's been coming out lately, they must have been deliberately murdering kids and burying them underneath the schools.
Underneath or close by.
We're not talking the odd one here or there. Like, this is, you said 250 kids from one school. Another one, possibly 800.
800.
Man, isn't that sad? Like you said, for the ones that survived and made it through, the resilience that they would have shown to actually withstand the experience that they went through, incredible.
As children.
Yeah.
As children.
And so it's a pity that native language, the culture, was actually really suppressed from them being able to use that and enjoy that at that time. And so then no wonder they've had these other issues, challenges later on in their life as they get older. So the key things, which were from the emotional well-being's point of view, you mentioned they felt the shame, not worthy, not good enough,
not almost wanted.
Like not wanted, like their identity that they were was they shouldn't be who they were naturally.
Right. Yeah. And,
so
and of course, growing up in the residential school, they had no idea about who they were because they were robbed of their identity, part of which is language, and no connection to home, no connection to the ceremonies, no connection to the songs, the dances, which is a great part of who we are. And of course, then when we start looking at home, think about what you would do if your children were taken.
Yeah.
What would you do to bury the pain of losing your children?
Yeah, turn to things that make you feel better.
Exactly. And so when the children would return home, life was chaos at home too because of all the disruption because of colonization and having your children taken and being forced on this piece of land, being forced to being dependent, being starved, and so on and so forth. So there were so many issues at play. It's difficult to just to name one.
Yeah.
And so what we're dealing with today are the impacts of colonization.
How many generations are we talking about at this point in time, even the kids today?
Yeah, probably 7 or 8 generations at least.
Yeah.
And of course, for some people, their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents went to residential school. It may even extend further back as well. So there's generations of our people that have been harmed over and over again. And I'm going to go back to, we're still here.
Yeah.
We're still here, and we're fighting.
And a lot of the traditions, the ceremonies, the culture has survived with it.
Yeah, it's survived and it's rebounding right now. It's coming back. A lot of our people are beginning to learn the language. A lot of our people are learning the ceremonies, the songs, the dances, looking at identity. What does it mean to be Haudenosaunee? What does it mean to be Cree? What does it mean to be Coast Salish? And looking at that piece. And a big piece of it is getting that sense of belonging within yourself. Who am I?
Yeah.
Where do I come from? Where do I belong? And as opposed to getting it externally, we have to get it internally first. So doing all the work to shed ourselves of the pain and hurt and the impacts of colonization.
To know that you don't have to be ashamed of who you really are.
That's right. And of course, Canada still is a racist country.
Yeah.
Just as is Australia.
Yeah.
And many of our people face racism on a daily basis.
If you look back to where things are, if you look to where things are now from where we've come from in the time that's happened, let's say 1800s to now, are you feeling hopeful that where we're at today and the speed at which things are changing, there's some optimism about where things are heading with this?
I believe so. And I've worked in the field of addictions and trauma for 38 years now. And I have seen positive change. And, you know, where 38 years ago, we didn't look at trauma when we were treating addicts. We didn't look at trauma at all. But now we have to look at the underlying issues to addiction. And so a lot of trauma is being looked at. But I also think, too, is that with the increasing amount of the impacts of trauma and colonization, even though with all the work that is being done across the country, some days it feels like it's not enough.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example, and you probably heard about it here. In early September, I believe it was, a young man, a reserve in Saskatchewan, who had some mental health issues and issues with the law. He'd been in and out of jail, went on a killing rampage in his community. And he stabbed to death 11 people and injured 18 others. And so my big fear is, are we going to see more incidents like that? Whether it be in Canada or in New Zealand or here in Australia, because I believe that we're just not dealing with the well-being of our people fast enough. And in dealing with the well-being of our people, to be able to tell your story is very scary for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Very scary. And so they find other ways to get it out. And of course, as you probably have experienced here, there's a lot of anger within our people because of what has happened to us. And you combine that with alcohol or drugs or both.
Yeah.
And it turns into rage.
The impact that alcohol has had on Indigenous First Nations over there in Canada, is it similar to here with domestic violence, family violence going up?
Very much.
Crime.
Very much. Yeah. And we see it, we're seeing it more the last couple of years because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And with the isolation that people were forced into because of the pandemic and not being able to deal with some of these issues. And so a lot of the communities I work with across Canada are saying, yeah, it's getting worse, or it has gotten worse in our communities because of the pandemic. But also, too, that the services just can't keep up. So, for example, I mean, there's probably, I'm going to say maybe 40 or 50 alcohol and drug treatment centers that are First Nation operated. I would probably say most of them, if not all of them, have long waiting lists.
They're on.
So you might have, if you want to get a person in treatment, you might have to wait 2 or 3 months. But by that time, it might be too late.
What about the incarceration?
Incarceration is extremely high. Like, I think the last I read something about, of the women in jail, 50% are Indigenous.
Wow. What percentage of the population is Indigenous over there?
I'm going to say 5%.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's way overrepresented.
It's sad.
Yeah.
And what we know today is the Western ways of dealing with trauma aren't working for us.
No.
And jails don't work for us. And what we're seeing too is that the reason why people are in jail is because of all the unresolved trauma and issues related to that.
Yep. Then there's a wait to get the help.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. So what do you think, Rob, like, what's the solution to all this? What needs to happen? What needs to change in order to reduce those rates of incarceration, to address the trauma?
We need to be able to develop our own programs based on our way, based on our culture, based on our ceremonies, based on our connection to the land. And that piece is really important. Now, for years, we've had the Western way shoved down our throats. And yet, there's some of it has been a little bit helpful, but we aren't. For example, in Canada, to have our traditional healers recognized as healers, a lot of external agencies will not recognize them as healers because they don't have the university credentials. But that's, and of course, what happens when help does come from the outside, we have to train them how to work with us.
Yeah, which you're training them anyway.
Yeah, and so we need to be given, or we need to take what is ours and use it.
Yeah.
And to not back down when another way is forced upon us.
Yeah, to get that confidence back as well, and to say, hang on, we already know what we're doing.
Yes, let us do it our way.
Yeah.
Back off.
So is there that sentiment? Is that out there? Is there change? Is there more of a...
It's getting stronger and stronger all the time. More and more of our people are beginning to stand up, but we need a lot more to stand up. We need a lot more of our people addressing their wellness issues, addressing the trauma, addressing the shame, addressing the abandonment that all stems from the acts of colonization, like residential schools. And so we've got to be able to address those issues our way. And what we're seeing is really helpful is addressing these issues on the land.
Yeah.
And because there's such a strong connection to the land, as is with the Aboriginal people here in Australia, connection to the land is strong. And people change when they're out on the land. And so to be able to work to understand who you are and where you're from and what it means is stronger on the land, but also resolving a lot of these issues as well is done better on the land.
And do you find the education of the culture is there more opportunities for that to happen with younger generations to get that ceremony, to get the language?
Very much. And you see young people who are learning the ceremonies at a young age. Mm. And that's wonderful to see. It's really powerful to see that. We see a lot more people learning the language. And it makes them stronger individuals because then they know who they are. They know who they are. And it's easier for them to stand up when they know who they are.
Yeah.
When they're connected to themselves, connected to each other, and connected to the land. And of course, with colonization, we become so disconnected as a people.
Yeah, it is sad, isn't it, how that's all happened? And you hope that, like you said, things are turning around and there's some positive steps that are being taken to provide those opportunities and get that awareness and that education back around that. But the trauma, you'd like to hope that they address that trauma and the underlying issues for that as well, and they get the people power to be able to do that, because like you say, it's about resources, right?
It's very much about resources, and of course one of the things that we need to look at too is trying to make it safe for people to do their healing work. And for many trauma survivors, no matter where they are, they don't feel safe. And that's one of the impacts of trauma on the brain. trauma totally disconnects our brain, and one of the results is not feeling safe.
It's one hand, you can't blame them, can you, for what they went through? So you're like, man, isn't it? It's just, and the more of these things that are coming out, and like you mentioned, these boarding schools, residential boarding schools, and the things that would have been going on there are horrific. But it sounds like there's going to be more things coming out about this as well.
I expect there will be. And of course, one of the big issues at home too has been the investigation into the missing and murdered Indian women and girls.
Mm.
And so that's coming out as well too, in terms of where all are women disappearing to. They're either missing or turn up murdered.
With the addiction side of things, with drugs, alcohol, how prevalent is it becoming over there, or where is it at the moment? Are you seeing some changes? Do they have non-alcoholic areas where they're not allowed to have alcohol in those communities or reserves?
There are some reserves that have been designated dry reserves, but because trauma is still an issue, people will find a way to bring the alcohol into the community. Now, in terms of looking at addressing alcohol, a lot of work has been done, but we still need more and more. But it's not so much addressing the usage of alcohol, it's addressing the underlying issues of why people drink. Yeah. And that's what's scary for a lot of people to
deal with.
To deal with, exactly. But in all the communities I worked with across Canada, they all say their number one problem is alcohol and drug abuse. And of course, with drug pushers coming into the community, and I just read recently that one community has banned two or three of drug pushers, and they're not allowed, and they're being backed up by the police as well.
What's a drug pusher?
Someone that sells drugs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dealers,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the fact that it's now becoming so cheap and readily available is the concerning part.
And the most concerning part is what are some of these drugs laced with, because we've had a lot of overdoses in Canada.
Is that right?
Within our population, which I'm sure it's no different here. A lot of overdoses. It's scary.
It's, like you said, what's the underlying behavior that's making them turn to that?
It's the pain and the hurt from all the trauma.
So what do you think that's your biggest, not yours, but do you think that's the biggest challenge moving forward in order to overcome the trauma, is actually just getting the resources to help?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the resources that enable us to do it our way.
Which you seem to have, you're saying that you've got a bit more support now with the government, and there's a bit more acknowledgement that needs to happen that way.
Yes.
Okay.
And of course, right now it's the lack of resources.
Yeah.
When you take, for example, I'm working with some nations in northern British Columbia, and they just got the funding to build a $20 million treatment facility out on the land. It has a strong on-the-land component to it. But think about the staffing for that, what that's going to cost to treat 35. So it's not cheap.
No.
And our view is that you put us here, you help us get better.
Yeah.
But we have to do it our way.
Those reserves still exist?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
See, all First Nations in Canada still have to operate under the Indian Act, which was done in 1869, maybe, shortly after Confederation in 1867. And today the Indian Act is the most racist piece of legislation in the world.
And it's still there?
Still there.
What's it say? You have to live on the reserve.
It doesn't say that, but there are certain laws we have to abide by when we live on the reserve.
Oh, so they're not your own laws?
No, we aren't. No, they aren't our own laws at all. And so we totally, if we want to get the funding to survive, we have to abide by the Indian Act.
Wow. Is there any chance that will get amended or revoked?
Well, we've been trying for years to get it amended, but it's just been a struggle to get it changed. And what we hear lately is the government is looking at it. Now, if any change will come, I don't know. Or whether, who knows, maybe the changes will be negative as opposed to positive.
Do you have your own law on those reserves? Law enforcement? No.
Some reserves in Canada have their own law force. We have our own police on my reserve. That's funded by Ontario Provincial Police, but we're underfunded, so we can't offer 24/7 coverage.
Man, that's just so interesting, isn't it? Uh-huh. so many similarities with Australia and New Zealand and how this.
I've been over here several times. I've been over to New Zealand several times, and there's way more similarities than differences. Way more.
And is that because it was a Commonwealth approach?
Yes.
Yeah. The systems and the laws and the treatment that was all impressed upon.
Yes. And it was all about taking our land and resources.
Yeah.
Getting rid of us so they would have free access to land and resources.
Rod, I don't know. I think it's been really interesting to hear what's going on over there in Canada. And I'm certainly glad that you've made the trip to Australia and telling us and the delegates all about this. But really, I'm really appreciative of your time to be able to share this with our people. How do people get a hold of you if they want to know more?
Okay. Before we go there, what I just want to say is in September of 2023, we're hosting Healing Our Spirit Worldwide, which is an international Indigenous gathering.
That's a big one.
That focuses on the health and healing of our people, focusing on our programs, our way. And it's September 11th to 15th in Vancouver. And the call for abstracts is still open. The website is www.hosw.com. And so we're expecting between 4,000 and 5,000 people from around the world.
Wow.
The last one was held here in Australia in 2018.
Where was that, Sydney?
Sydney.
Yes. Yeah, Healing Our Spirits.
Healing Our Spirit.
Spirit. Okay.
Worldwide.
Worldwide. I've heard really good things about that conference.
Yeah, I'm the chairperson of the International Indigenous Council for Healing Our Spirit Worldwide.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah. So in terms of getting a hold of me, probably the best way is via email.
Yep.
My email is avisionsrod, A-V-I-S-I-O-N-S-R-O-D @gmail.com. Or if you get to the website, I believe there's an email address there as well. Yep.
And then otherwise, yeah, if you want to speak at this conference, Healing Our Spirit Worldwide, opportunity is still there.
Yeah, the abstract deadline is November 25th.
Yeah, and that's in Vancouver in September 11 to 15, 2023.
And for more information, go onto the website.
Cool. Well, that's been really good. I appreciate your time, Rod. Thanks so much for sharing your insights and having a chat with me. It's been really interesting. And yeah, just thought it'd been blown away by the similarities that exist between the history of the invasion of colonization upon your country and others. It just sounds such a, it all rhymes with each other, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Yeah. Mate, let's pray that they get the resources in the right places in Canada and they get the healing and address the trauma and the underlying issues to try and help.
Yeah, and same here in Australia.
Yeah.
But I know it's an uphill battle here in Australia.
It is. Thanks, Rod. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sam. I certainly appreciate being here.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at anzmha, on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.